Okay, thanks all for coming. Good morning, and thanks to the organizers for inviting me to this program. So I would like to tell you a bit about the connections between quantum integrability and the entanglement spectrum. So this is going to be a rather general kind of talk, asking some rather broad questions about these quantum many-body systems that look like this. At least that's how I imagine it. If we can look at their Hilbert space, we would see something like this. And so we would like to see, you know, there's obviously some correlations and entanglement created there, so we'd like to see, get a sense of where it came from. Okay, so this talk is basically, we feel a little bit like in this Kubrick movie. So we're given some kind of unknown many-body state, and then we would like to, you know, get a sense of what it is. And of course, there are many, many questions that we can ask about it. For example, we would like to know where it came from. And we would like to know if it represents, you know, a result of some intelligent design. Okay? So these are the two kinds of questions that I will discuss today. More specifically, so the first one would be try to understand some universal properties that we find in the eigenstates of systems that are out of equilibrium, so interacting systems with strong disorder. And those will be revealed by their entanglement spectra. And the second question is, so I will ask, if we are given some kind of state like this, how far is it from any possible free state? Okay, so free states are simple, we have many techniques to understand them, but on the other hand, strong interacting systems are much harder. So in that sense, intelligent design is, you know, something possibly non-perturbative result of some interactions between particles in a system. Okay, so the entanglement spectrum, I guess I don't really need to introduce it very much here, but so if we have some many-body state, what we do is we cut it in two parts, A and B, and then to describe the part A, we form the reduced density matrix row A by tracing out the B part, so we assume that this is a pure state. And then, you know, from that reduced density matrix, we can calculate various things. For example, we can calculate the von Neumann entropy. And now we can ask various questions. Okay, so one illuminating thing to ask is how that von Neumann entropy scales with the, you know, size of that subsystem A. Of course, if we have entropy zero, it's a kind of a boring product state. But then there could be other possibilities. So the entropy could scale as a volume, and that's what you will find in random states or thermal states. And perhaps more interestingly, you can find that it scales as an area of that subsystem, and there could be some subleading corrections. So this is particularly interesting in the context of topological states.
So, question, just to understand how much structure you're assuming at the beginning, there's a geometric localization of the degrees of freedom at the beginning, so that we can define the areas A and
C. So we're assuming that we're making a physical real space partition of this system.
Okay, so the, because on slide one, that wasn't necessarily true. I could have a system where I have n spins that are all coupled to each other, and there's no geometric.
What do you mean by coupled to each other?
Like, I write down a Hamiltonian that has a bilinear term for every pair of spins.
Sure, that's fine.
So, but then I wouldn't know what regions A. I'm just trying, is there a geometric location?
You have a spin chain, right?
Okay.
And then there's like a pairwise interaction.
Well, I don't necessarily have a spin chain. This is my question.
Okay, so we assume, let's assume here maybe there is some kind of lattice structure here.
Okay.
We are talking about, it's not actually necessary. So you can do this for like a continuum system as well. But we are going to be cutting the system in real space.
Okay.
So we make a sharp partition between two spatial regions, A and B. That's what's
okay. So we have to have a notion of real space at the beginning.
Let's assume that, yes. Actually, you know, one can imagine also partitioning momentum space,
sure,
modes and things like that. But most of this will be real space. Okay, so there are interesting things that you can find out here, but it's really limited information because you get like one quantity to look at. So the idea of the entanglement spectrum, as introduced by Lee and Haldane, is to look at the full spectrum of these Schmidt coefficients of a given many-body state. And so a surprising result, so this was introduced for a particular system, which is the fractional quantum Hall effect, So the Laughlin state at 1/3, if you look at these Schmidt coefficients, they can be organized by a certain symmetry quantum number, which is the momentum in the subsystem A. And then if you plot them, it looks like a gapless sort of energy spectrum. And interestingly, this gapless excitation could be related to an actual edge state of that system, because the topological gapped phases, they have these propagating gapless edge states. So that was interesting, but it actually wasn't the full story, because if you go to look at other states, then you find that this entanglement spectrum really works as a fingerprint for a topological model. So there's another state, which is some different filling fraction, usually known as 5/2 state. And in that case, in that state, the entanglement spectrum actually depends on how you cut your state. So if I have like two electrons separated by some empty space and then two other electrons, for example, I can cut either, you know, in this empty space, or I can cut between the two electrons. And if you look at the entanglement spectra, they will actually be different. So in particular, if you look at the number of these levels, the Schmidt coefficients, in this case, it would be like 1, 1, 3, and here 1, 2, 4. So there's a difference, and this is a fingerprint of the non-abelian topological order in this case.
Issues of the cut when you cut between the two electrons?
So here you have like single particle orbitals. Okay. So you actually, what I mean by cutting between the electrons, I mean fixing a certain number of particles on the left side of your system. So because
there's a part of the wave function with a given number.
Yes, it has a fixed number of particles, so it's block diagonal in the number of particles on the left side. So if you look at the certain number of these particles on the left, it will correspond to one of these two cuts. And then you can see by comparing that you get different spectra.
So can you maybe repeat again? What is different? I mean, visually I see far fewer lines. That's all I see.
Okay, yeah. So the universal information in all this is this counting of these levels per momentum sector. So if I look here, I have 1, 1, 2, 3, 5, etc. So that's topological information there. Here, if you do the same, you see that here I have, it's a bit blurred, but it's going to be 1, 1, 3. And here it will be 1, 2, 4. So the countings are clearly different in the two cases.
Why do I start from 65 as opposed to 0?
It's just an arbitrary convention how you calculate this number. It doesn't really matter what the precise value here is, just how many of these states. Okay, so the point is, for this talk, is there more generic content that we can get out of this entanglement spectrum? Something that's perhaps independent of, you know, geometric or conformal symmetries that the system might have. Okay, so that brings me to the first part of the talk. So this is inspired by a very general question, which is, in recent years in particular, we'd like to get some kind of general understanding of, you know, all sorts of possible behaviors that isolated quantum many-body systems can have at arbitrary temperature. And so this, you know, is still an open problem even in one dimension. And the interesting aspect of that question is that you don't normally we just care about the ground state of our system, but now we talk about arbitrary temperature, so we would like to understand also arbitrarily excited eigenstates of such systems. And this makes it much more complicated to tackle in a technical sense. So to be more specific, we can imagine an isolated quantum many-body system like a spin chain, a simple one-dimensional spin chain with nearest neighbor hopping, interaction, and quench disorder. So disorder is like a random field on each side. So that's some simple Hamiltonian that looks like that. Or because we are in 1D, by Jordan-Bingham transformation, we can also see that as a fermionic, 1D spinless Hubbard model, basically. So again, nearest neighbor hopping, interaction, and now some on-site disorder as well. So these are the kind of systems that we're interested in. And so what happened in recent years was, you know, when people seriously started looking at phase diagrams of such models, and it was discovered that at least there are two kind of generic phases that we find in such phase diagrams. So one is the kind of familiar ergodic phase, So if we have this model with spin chain, and let's set J to 1, and let's set this random field to be some large number. So it's a strongly disordered system. Then if we crank up V so that it's much larger than any of these two energy scales, then we will get into an ergodic phase. So that's a phase that we know quite well, because it means that the entire system acts as a heat bath. So the system can achieve thermal equilibrium, and there's also finite transport of particles and energy and so on. And what's important from the entanglement point of view is that entanglement is extensive. So the entanglement entropy scales as a volume of the subsystem. Now, what became interesting is that when people also started thinking more seriously about not-so-strong interactions, and then it was realized that there's actually another phase that we now refer to as a many-body localized phase. So the interesting point about that phase is, first of all, it's not ergodic. So that system cannot act as a heat bath. There is no sense of thermal equilibrium. And also transport is suppressed. And all that is also reflected in entanglement properties. So if you look at the entanglement entropy, it doesn't scale as a volume, but as an area of the subsystem. Fair question?
Yeah. So when you pose the problem as what is the generic behavior of a closed quantum system at temperature T, don't you already assume that there's a global thermodynamic equilibrium?
Okay, I shouldn't have put T there. I should have said it was a sort of colloquial sentence. But what I meant is about arbitrarily excited eigenstates of that system.
There
doesn't have to be a notion of temperature. Indeed, in this kind of system, we might not have any kind of ordinary notion of temperature. But we still have eigenstates at certain energy density, and we can discuss energy densities which are much beyond the ground state, right? So that's what we're interested in. And of course, a special interesting point of this is you completely turn off interactions, then in a 1D system you have Anderson localization, which is very well known. All right, so how did we learn about actually all this? Well, one particularly interesting thing was to consider the dynamics of entanglement in these systems. And for example, in a global quench, so you prepare some well-defined initial state. So if you have like all spins pointing up or down, and then you evolve it. So that's not an eigenstate of your Hamiltonian, but you evolve it with the Hamiltonian, and you observe what happens at later times. And this is quite simple for us because we consider a closed system, so it's unitary evolution. So you just calculate that basically. So we know what to expect, for example, if you have an ergodic system or Anderson insulators. So for an ergodic system, this entropy will increase, I think, generally as a power law, as a function of time. In fact, you can show for certain systems using conformal field theory that it just has to be linear. Whereas if you have an Anderson insulator, there's going to be some growth of entropy, but it will saturate beyond the time scale, which is the inverse hopping. Because you can only grow entropy by a small amount, which is by having a single particle hop around where you cut your system.
I got confused. So what's the role of the random magnetic field? You have to add to that field, the H, the previous
slide. So that's in the Hamiltonian.
No, I'm talking about the H. This HR is a random field.
Yeah, that's a random field.
So everything depends on this random field.
Of course, so yes.
What kind of distribution is a Gaussian distribution?
So in principle, the results are not particularly sensitive to what kind of distribution you pick. For simplicity, let's say we pick the uniform distribution. So it's just uniform and distributed between some minus.
So if there's no random field, everything is ergodic.
Yes.
So only when you add this random field.
Yes. But we will assume that that field is strong. So it can so that it's a non-zero field in general. So then if you tune the strength of that, you can actually see a difference between ergodic and something else.
Okay, so that scale, why that scale is independent of H, the next slide, the Anderson, this is the T star, why is it independent of H?
So in 1D, if you have F, the system will localize for any amount of disorder.
So
here we just discuss 1D case.
So H could be very small.
Could be very small. Okay.
May I also ask?
Yeah.
Can I ask a question about your previous stuff?
Yeah.
These little red figures, what is the connection with the Hamiltonian about?
Okay, so these figures, they tell you about the statistics of energy levels. So the difference between ergodic phase and many body localized phase is reflected in the statistics of energy level spacings in your system. So if you have an ergodic system, that's an old result. So it's known that the statistics has to be Wigner-Dyson because you get level repulsion. Whereas if you have a localized system, then it will actually turn into a Poisson statistics. So by looking at that, you can also see there's a transition happening here. All right, so by looking at the dynamics of this entanglement, we can probe different regimes in the system, and this is quite exciting because these days people are actually able to measure these things. So this is a result of measuring Grignani entropy in a system of rubidium atoms recently. Now, I mentioned there's this kind of special phase, which we call many-body localized phase. So what do we expect for the dynamics of entanglement in that phase? So you can do numerical simulations as a theorist. And so here's what you see. So at small times, the entropy grows, just like in Anderson case. But whereas the Anderson case completely saturates at the time scale of 1 over j, if you have a many-body localized system, so there's a non-zero interaction, then this entropy keeps growing further, okay? And that growth is particularly slow because, as you see, this is a log scale here. So it's quite a slow growth of entropy. So this is something that emerged as a result in first in 2008, but it wasn't paid much attention. And then since 2012, this result generated a lot of discussions, and it led to to some important insights about many-body localized phases. So how do we understand this result? Well, let me give you a little hint. So let's do a Gedanken experiment where we have this chain. So this is a spin chain. And now we're going to cut it in the middle, okay? So we don't allow any hopping between these two middle sides, but we keep the interaction that connects these two sides. And you do the same quench as before, okay? So what do you expect? Okay, so this is the result. So if we do the same calculation as before, we see that entropy as a function of time now stays zero up to the time scale 1 over j. Yeah.
Why did you change the Hamiltonian? I mean, you still start with a random initial state, I guess?
Yes, you can pick any kind of product state you like. But the Hamiltonian, we've cut the bond that connects these two little spins, but we keep the interaction term across the bond. It's just a kind of Gedanken experiment that will illuminate why we get this kind of result. So if we do a calculation, now we see that entropy stays zero in the beginning because, you know, the bond has been cut, so nothing moves across that bond. So entropy is zero, but then it starts growing again logarithmically in time. So that's the first observation that we can make. The second thing, we can calculate the actual variance of the magnetization in the left part of the system, and we see that that thing is nearly zero at all times. Okay? So what this tells us is that there is nothing seems to be moving across this cut, so there are no particles in fermionic language that hop from A to B. But somehow this entropy still grows logarithmically in time. And what this means is that essentially you can, what happens is that any two subsystems that you have, they can get entangled, but that entanglement arises from their direct interaction, which is exponentially suppressed in the distance between the subsystems.
What? I'm missing that. Why?
Well,
I mean, physically,
you're not transporting anything across this cut. So there's not like an excitation which would propagate and then build some entanglement. So the simplest scenario is that generically these two subsystems will just get entangled through a direct interaction because nothing else seems to be moving between them.
You mean an effective interaction?
Yes, some kind of effective interaction.
Okay, then.
Yeah.
This J in your box is not tunneling, right?
It's not, no, this is some effective interaction that arose between these two. It has nothing to do with the original J that we had. So this simple picture basically led to several groups to propose that you can phenomenologically explain this result by saying that the effective Hamiltonian in the MBL phase can be written as a classical Hamiltonian in terms of some new spin variables that are called that we call here tau z's. Okay. So now the interesting features about these Hamiltonian, first of all, you see that only tau z's are involved, and there are several terms. So the first term is just a single particle term. Then we get a two particle term, but it's only of the size z z. So there's only so the system is completely classical, if you wish. So it only involves z's and powers of z's, products of z's. Okay. And these taus, these pseudospins, they're conserved, so they commute with the Hamiltonian, and they also commute between themselves on different sides. And there are extensively many of them. So if you had a spin chain of size L, you would get L of these guys. Okay? And actually, in some recent work, we've explicitly constructed these taus. And when you do that, you see that these taus, as expected from this picture here, they're actually exponentially localized. And so each tau is exponentially localized on any given side. So if I look at the side I, there's a tau there, which looks like the original spin sigma. But then it also has some spread over different sides. And that the weight of that operator on other sides decays exponentially. So taus can be thought of original spins, but dressed with some unitary operation that builds a little bit longer tail in this. So what are the important consequences of this? Well, first, because if you have extensively many of these taus that commute with the Hamiltonian, your system will not relax. So that's one important thing. And this is indeed measured. So if you prepare, in a coiled atom system, you prepare some initial pattern, which is like a charge density wave state, then you can look at how that pattern of 0, 1, 0, 1 evolves over time. And so what people see here is that if you have no disorder, that pattern immediately disappears after a very short time. But if you have strong disorder, the pattern actually seems to stay non-zero at very long times. So the system fails to relax. The pattern, the memory of the initial state survives indefinitely, in a sense. So that's one consequence. The other consequence, which is important for us, is that the eigenstates actually have area law entanglement. Okay. So what does that mean? It means that if you have, let's say you have eigenstates of two small systems, and now you want to construct an eigenstate of a bigger system that's a union of these.
So can I ask about this figure lower left?
Yeah.
Do I consider that an impressive comparison between the theory I met and the solid line?
It's not
a sort of so-so comparison.
I don't think this result is particularly impressive in the sense that, first of all, it doesn't give us evidence that there's some interaction physics going on here. Because, you know, even in an Anderson insulator, the pattern will survive. So if you prepare a charge density wave state, it might survive. So in a sense, we don't know if it's many body localization or single particle localization. But I guess your question was about the agreement between these two.
Yeah, what should I be impressed about? I mean, the oscillations, for example, I don't see back in the experiment at all. So do I need to look at the asymptotic building?
Yeah, the what they wanted to show is the asymptotic value, yes. I actually don't really know what the line represents. But the asymptotic value is what we want. And also, these are very short time scales, so.
I think the line is gamma RG simulation of their model.
Okay, perhaps. I really don't know.
If I remember the paper correctly, the line is gamma RG simulation of the model.
All right. So
is this still the case with the J equals 0 in the top left or not?
Sorry, what?
these results are these still for a system that's cut?
No. This is for like the original system that has hopping and without any cuts. Okay.
Also the phenomenological Hamiltonian is.
Well, the phenomenological Hamiltonian is a phenomenological Hamiltonian. This is an actual, you know, experimental Hamiltonian, which is really something like this. Although this sort of term is actually not fully random, I think, but quasi-random. But for practical purposes, you can think of it as such a Hamiltonian.
So we should probably also comment that the Elbert Hamiltonian is stronger than we need for the experiment, right? Yeah. I mean, that implies that for sure.
Yeah.
It doesn't go the other way.
It's not necessarily the other way around, yeah. Okay, so... I think I won't advance very far, but that's fine. Yeah.
When you cut this thing, right, you get this, the top figure, this flat thing, and then it increases for the tangent. If you didn't do that, if you kept J finite, it would go up linear on this scale, right?
So yeah, so then you would get something like this. So this is when you have a full model, and then it increases.
But it also flat still in the beginning, and then it increases.
Well, this is a log, so.
The other one too, I guess.
Which other one?
The next one.
Oh, that one, but that one is zero, right? So there's nothing here. So there's nothing in that case. So from this, we can sort of see that this happens because...
It also starts at zero.
Of course, it has to start at zero because we prepare a product state in the beginning.
Got that. So what's special? I mean, what's special about your test example? I'm missing what I should get out of it.
Okay, so there are here, there are clearly there's a dynamics which kind of happens on two different time scales, right? So there's something fast and there's something slow. And here we see that, you know, the fast one is really coming from the fact that the single particle effect, you know, hopping across the bond where you calculate the entanglement. So we can rule that out by simply cutting the chain, and then that thing is completely gone.
I mean, otherwise I would have within a unit of one, I would have seen a rapid increase.
Yeah, exactly like here. So it increases very fast. So then you prevented that, but you still have this slow dynamics, which comes from the fact that you have these non-local couplings between the tau pseudospins. So the direct interaction between these pseudospins gives you this piece. Okay, so what I was going to say is that another consequence of Hamiltonian like this is that you have area law entanglement in your eigenstates. So what does that mean? If I have two systems and I know their eigenstates, I can ask the question, what are the eigenstates of a coupled system? So when I make a union of these two. So then what follows from this is that the eigenstates are basically the product states, the product of the eigenstates of the smaller systems. But they are corrected by some unitary operations that act near the boundary of these subsystems. So that's what gives you the area law entanglement, because these unitaries, they are only supported on some area around the cut between these different systems. And this is so the fact that there's area law entanglement in these eigenstates led to some people saying that, I mean, colloquially, often people say that MBL eigenstates can be thought of as being similar to the ground states of gapped systems, because in 1D, when you have a gapped system, we know that there should be area law entanglement. Okay, so but there's a little twist that that I will discuss in the next part, which is why this is not quite completely. Okay, so we have these local integrals of motion in the MBL phase. This picture that I presented here is quite well established and accepted by now. And that tells us that entropy has to obey the area law. But what about the entanglement spectrum? So that's something that we want to address now. Okay, so let me just remind you a little bit about the known universal properties of the entanglement spectrum in various parameters. So here I've selected two. So first, we know quite a lot about the entanglement spectrum in 1D critical systems. For example, this is the entanglement spectrum of a transverse field Ising model, which is free, so you can solve it exactly. And then you find that, so these are the Schmidt coefficients as a function of their numbers, so they're ordered from the largest to smallest. And then these Schmidt coefficients can be shown to decay rather fast. So the decay is e to the minus some constant and then log k squared. So it's not quite exponential decay, but it's rather fast. And in fact, it kind of is exponential decay for the first few, which also explains why DMMG simulations are very successful in those systems. So, okay, so that's what we know about 1D critical systems. And of course, this can be generalized to a larger class by using the results from conformal field theory.
You have several curves corresponding to different values of lambda.
Right. So this is the field when you tune between being in a gapped phase towards the gapless phase, towards the transition, basically. So this is when you have a gap. So then there's basically exponential decay in the largest coefficients, and then develops some kind of tail. But actually, the same kind of law will hold even at the critical point. It's just that the lambda constant there will depend on system size. So it always looks like this, but alpha can be size dependent if you're at the critical point. Okay, so that's what we know about simple models in 1D for the ground state, of course. Now, the other something else that recently was discussed was, what does the entanglement spectrum look like if you have a random system, so something thermal, eigenstates of thermal systems. So then, basically, the entanglement spectrum looks like this. So it's rather flat. And actually, it can be almost exactly described by a certain distribution, which is called the Marchenko-Pastour distribution. So this is the distribution, well, it looks like this. But basically, it describes density of eigenvalues of a Wishart matrix. So that's a matrix that looks like some matrix X times X dagger. So X is a random matrix where entries are, let's say, Gaussian distributed. And so that's like a matrix that represents your state, if you wish. And then the matrix that represents the reduced density matrix is like X times X dagger. So because of this, you get the entanglement spectrum that's very flat, and it obeys this distribution, which also agrees quite well with numerical comparisons with, let's say, eigenstates of thermal system, just like in our model that we have here, but not picking very large disorders, so somewhere in the ergodic phase. So that's sort of what we know. And now what we add to this is the result for the many-body localized phase. So let me just first summarize what the main result is, and then I'll see what else I can cover. So we basically establish that the universal thing that we can say about many-body localized systems is that their entanglement spectrum obeys a power law. Okay? So it's a little bit different from, let's say, 1D critical systems, where it clearly decays faster than any power law. And it's also different from these ergodic systems, where it's extremely flat. Okay? So this is a typical spectrum of an MBL system, the entanglement spectrum. So it's a linear on a log-log plot. So this power law is controlled by this parameter gamma, which is basically related to the analog of localization length. So, but it's a many-body system, so we call it many-body localization length. Okay, what are the main things that I want to say? So first, there's no symmetry here, okay? So now the important thing is we look at the effective quantum number, which is really the Schmidt rank. So we just look at, you know, how these Schmidt values behave as a function of the rank. So that's the first point. Second point.
So you're talking about Schmidt rank, so there should be some truncation, right? I mean, numerically, when you truncate, what's
the... So let me come to that. So So first, this is one difference from the typical ground states, because if you have a gapped ground state, the Schmidt coefficients will decay exponentially. So even though both will have entropy that grows as area of the subsystem, the entanglement spectrum qualitatively is different here. And okay, so yes, as the question was suggesting, so this is useful if you're doing numerical calculations, because now you have some expectation of how these Schmidt coefficients are supposed to decay. So this is very useful to benchmark any kind of simulations that rely on such schemes. So if we had an infinite system, so this power law would behave, you know, it would persist indefinitely. Okay, so this thing will just continue straight to very small numbers, but it's already quite small, as you see here. Then of course, a finite system by itself will impose some kind of truncation on this, and that's reflected in these tails here. So we actually found a way to describe these tails, so they can actually be fitted by what's called the order statistics of the Gaussian distribution. So that looks sort of like this. So it's like an inverse error function, and it gives a really good fit to these tails, which are really the finite size effect. Okay, so the power law, in an infinite system will just persist forever. Did I answer your question, or what was the question?
Yeah, I mean, in numerically, when you do this MTS benchmarking,
right?
So if you use Schmidt rank, you always have some truncation.
Yes.
I mean, what's the truncation error?
So you see here, we compare results from like exact dialization, and then this is the result from like MPS calculation, and that of course has a truncation, which means that we only get this the first few of these levels. So the truncation is naturally it's cutting off this part, but it's still an excellent agreement for these first few, because the power law is still relatively fast decay. So,
also in this plot, so are you in the deep localized region? Or?
Right. So this is the calculation when we are at strong disorder. So the system is localized.
So in the deep localized region.
Yes.
So you can do a much larger system size.
Sure. Then we can really push to bigger if we want. Yes. There is not a problem.
Is it really dependent on which energy density? Which?
So here we, for simplicity, we've looked at the middle of the spectrum, which is sort of the worst case scenario. I mean, that's where you maybe have the largest probability of getting, you know, blobs of resonant states from ergodic side. All this derivation was done under the assumption that we are at strong disorder, so all the eigenstates are localized. So then you can show that it's a power law. If you do some mixture, I will come to that in a bit. So.
But even in the systems, the ground state of this system, should it obey this power law, or should it obey the decay that you mentioned?
Well, a ground state can be very special, right? So I guess in this case, the ground state could be almost trivial, right? So I'm not even sure that it's kind of meaningful to... You might only get like very few levels because it's extremely close to a product state. So the point is we really want to average over at least some, you know, band of states rather than talking about single states. Because if I look at a single eigenstate, I mean, you may not see any kind of obvious power law. The point is, you have to look at the typical value of this thing. So you have to take a log of the Schmidt coefficients, average that, and then you'll get something like that.
So is this a result of averaging over some?
Yes. As usual in this calculation, you have to average over at least some band of states at a given energy density.
How many states?
So here. It's quite a lot. So we take many disorder realizations, first of all. So that's probably several thousands or tens of thousands for smaller systems. And then on top of that, for each disorder realization, you pick a band of at least several thousand eigenstates. So it's quite a lot.
So if I had a Hamiltonian which was not MBL but had exponentially decaying terms in the interactions, and look at the ground state of that, would that display this behavior too?
So that's an interesting question. I was kind of I was curious to find this power law in some examples of systems with in the ground state. Are you talking about the clean system or again?
Or just for a clean system.
Yeah. So I was curious to find this, but somehow in the literature I couldn't find any other clean system that would have this property. I would be quite curious to know if there is one. So in 1D, if you have a gapped system, first of all, then you will find exponential decay. So it's not a power law.
But even if the interaction in Hamiltonian are exponentially decaying, like correctly.
If it's a gapped one, I would expect it's still decaying exponentially.
Because I can just take my Hamiltonian to be minus the sum of all the elements with appropriate sign, and then the ground state is a ground state of that Hamiltonian. You know, the eigenstate becomes a ground state of that Hamiltonian, right?
Question is, what if you have a non-local Hamiltonian where the non-local terms have exponentially falling off weights? And I think in that case, I would imagine you...
It's possible. I do believe it's possible to reproduce this in some clean model. It's just that, just searching randomly in the literature, I did not see it worked out. But I don't believe it's forbidden to have this with some assumptions. But I would like to find it. So far, I don't know. Okay, so it looks like I don't have very much time. So I wanted to actually tell you a little bit about another topic. So I'm going to stop here. So we can discuss in private if you would like to know how we analytically prove that this is a power law when we are deep in the many-body localized phase. And I can also tell you about how we do these numerical simulations, because that's a story in itself, how you do MPS optimizations with all this. So let me just quickly tell you about the second topic, which is, so I promised to tell you a little bit about how, if we have this many-body state, we can measure how far it is from the closest possible free state, okay, some non-interacting state, which gives us the same, if you perform measurements on a subsystem, you'll get essentially the same results, whether you use the full many-body state or this closest free state. Okay, so the motivation here is actually rather similar to this machine learning business that people talk a lot these days. So you're blindfolded, right? And somebody gives you some generic quantum many-body state, and you would like to see whether that, how far it is from some kind of free state in some possibly rotated basis. So the basic strategy that we'll use here is, again, the entanglement spectrum, because the entanglement spectrum of a free system is highly constrained because it has to obey this combinatorial structure that essentially comes from the Wicks theorem. So the reduced density matrix of a free system is basically built from non-interacting modes. So these are the C dagger and C operators. And so if you look at the entanglement spectrum, so let's say in the simplest example, so if I have two modes, then I can have energies epsilon 1 and epsilon 2. Of course, I can have energy 0 if none of them are populated. And then I must have epsilon 1 plus epsilon 2 if both are populated, right? So that's Wicks' theorem. So you see that entanglement spectrum inherits a lot of constraints due to the fact that the system is free. If it's not, then all this structure will just break down. So we would like to have some kind of black box machine that can essentially give us the answer to that. And so to do that, we introduce this thing which we call interaction distance. So you have some many-body state, and then you cut it in half, let's say. So you get the reduced density matrix for the left part. And then you ask, can rho be distinguished from some free particle density matrix sigma? So as I said, sigma is written in this form, where C are some bosonic or, let's say, fermionic operators. So this interaction distance is basically trace distance. So this part here is trace distance between rho and sigma. And so we minimize that trace distance over all possible free states. Okay? So you take all unitary orbits of Gaussian states that forms this space F, And the minimum of that is what we call this interaction distance df. So this manifold contains all the free states. So let's say if you work with fermions, so you have these operators, C dagger C, which are fermion operators, but then you're allowed to do all unitary transformations on these operators. So that's what we mean by contains all unitary orbits.
How local?
Sorry?
The unitary transformations, how local do they have to be? Subsystem?
The unitary transformations have to be restricted to the subsystem. But in there, they can be anything. Right.
And they have to be tunnel.
They have to be what?
Because this looks like a tunnel state for sigma. Or is it random? Or?
No, this is a generic. You can write the free systems with this density matrix in this way, always.
Maybe you said this and I just missed it, but I mean, these are matrix operators, so what does rho minus sigma square root mean?
So the trace distance, so yeah, you can take like an absolute of rho minus sigma, basically.
Okay.
Because these are Hermitian and...
Okay. So you know, for every matrix element, you just take absolute value.
Yes. Okay, so there's this thing, but... One subtlety is that because, as Rahul was pointing out, these are operators, right? So if we want to compare these two operators, you would think it's quite complicated to do this minimization because it will also depend on the basis, right? So maybe I also need to optimize over different bases in which I represent my sigma. However, there are results which are just from basic linear algebra, which tells you that this minimum is actually going to be achieved when both rho and sigma are simultaneously diagonal. Okay, so they have to be simultaneously diagonal, and their eigenvalue spectra have to be rank ordered in the same way. So let's assume it's from biggest to smallest eigenvalue. So there are theorems that you can actually prove that that's how you achieve this minimum. And that's actually extremely useful because the consequence is that all you need to do is basically you need to vary these free entanglement energies that enter the description of sigma. So you don't have to worry about, you know, in which basis I'm going to look at. So you just compare the two spectra. And so then this df essentially becomes this simple sum where you take these many-body entanglement energies and you compare them with the free energies, which are given by, you know, some constant plus single particle energies, which are the variational parameters, and then these are the occupancies of these different modes. So for fermions, these could be 0 or 1. Okay? So you just have these L parameters, if you have, let's say, a lattice system of size L, and then you build 2 to the L levels by just populating these two. So that's how the state counting works. So you get this, you get 2 to the L levels over here, and you get 2 to the L levels over here. But ultimately, you're only minimizing over these L parameters, which is quite a small... It's not particularly challenging from the numerical point of view. Okay, so some general properties of this. So first of all, this df that I introduced really has... It's some kind of a distance, right? So it's bounded between 0 and 1 because this thing is actually related to fidelity. So then you can show that df has to be between 0 and 1. So that's one thing that's important. It's also kind of related to mean field theory, but it's much more general. So what we can safely say is that when mean field theory describes our ground state, then this quantity must go to 0. So then we just have, you know, a non-interacting system in terms of some dressed single particle modes, and df must exactly go to 0. So that's kind of expected. As I said, the calculation of that quantity is rather efficient because it basically scales polynomially with the number of levels that you have in the entanglement spectrum, so that's convenient. One thing that's important is that these free modes that you're going to find as a result of this variation, they do not necessarily have to be the original modes of your problem. So if you had some system which was defined in terms of fermions, let's say, well, we all know that, You can have a model which is defined in terms of fermions, but the effective low energy physics might be in terms of some new degrees of freedom, let's say bosonic degrees of freedom, right? So that's something that you would like for this thing to do. And you can actually do that. There's no restriction, because if you can view this many-body state in terms of the Schmidt decomposition, you can always, you're always free to add some rows and columns to these matrices, such that you can describe the Hilbert space of the same size for a different kind of particles, right? So if I had psi, which is defined in terms of fermions, I might look for some bosonic state that hides on the other side of this equation. But that's not a problem, because the different size of their Hilbert spaces can be matched by just adding these matrices with some extras, rows, and columns, and some zeros in the diagonal Schmidt matrix. So that's nice, that you can effectively recover some different degrees of freedom that describe your system. And one last thing is, also we also expect this quantity to behave as a kind of physical observable, in the sense that it obeys some finite size scaling at critical points. And so we generically expect it to behave like this at critical points. Now, there are three things I want to point out here. So this exponent, so we drive some quantum phase transition by changing some parameter g. So then there are going to be at least two critical exponents. So there's going to be this mu, which must be the actual correlation length exponent. Then there's this other exponent, which we call zeta. So that's something that will actually determine whether the effect of interactions is relevant or irrelevant in the RG sense. So I'll give an example how this works, actually. So that's something that we don't quite fully understand, but it's definitely there. And we also put here this strange-looking parameter theta, which is basically a tweak, because we need to satisfy this quantity is bounded. So if you want to do finite size scaling, as we saw from doing actual calculations, sometimes you actually need to put in this exponent, this parameter theta in there. Okay, so I guess we have to get out of here pretty soon. So let me just show you an example of all this. Okay, so we have a 1D quantumizing model. So we have ferromagnetic or antiferromagnetic coupling. We have the transverse field, and then we have the longitudinal field, which is an interaction. So this makes the model interacting. And so here in these plots, we computed this DF for the ferromagnetic case and for the antiferromagnetic case. So in the ferromagnetic case, so first of all, if we are on this line, which is the HZ line, then the system is always free, because it's a transversizing model. So DF is actually zero to machine precision. You don't maybe see it here, but it's always zero on the line. And the same thing here, because the models have the same physics. It's not affected by the sign of this coupling. And then the interesting thing is, in the rest of the phase diagram for the ferromagnetic case, we also find extremely small value of this DF. So you see these values are, so that's a log scale, and this is white, so it's like really, really small DF basically in the entire phase diagram. The only region where this DF becomes large is really close to this critical point. The antiferromagnetic case is slightly different. So there we actually find this entire line where DF is quite large. And so we know that actually once you add interactions in the antiferromagnetic case, the phase diagram becomes different from the ferromagnetic. So in that case, indeed, there is a whole critical line. But the entire critical line, at least according to previous work, is believed to be basically described by the same conformal field theory, just like this non-interacting point here. So it's the same kind of conformal field theory all the way on this line. And indeed, that's what we find this DF also to kind of sharply rise from non-zero value. So this is like your results from exact diagonalization for one system size. So then we can do finite size scaling. So let's look at DF along this cut, and we look at it here across this diagonal cut. So if we look at it here from along this cut, we see that it grows from smaller to larger system size. So this is 8, 10, 12, 14, etc. Then we can use the scaling that I mentioned previously, and we find these two critical exponents. So in particular, note that this zeta is now negative. Whereas if we do it in this case, we find the opposite. So df actually shrinks, so it goes down with system size. So 8, 12, 16, etc. And there we find some different scaling exponents. And the zeta is with opposite sign. Okay. So this tells you that the interactions have very different roles in the two cases. We can also compare this other exponent nu, because that's the correlation length exponent. So we can compare that with CFT. So in paper by Zamolochikov, these things were actually calculated when you have a small amount of longitudinal field. So you can use the perturbative CFT approach. And then this exponent becomes 8 over 15, which is relatively close to this. And it should be 1 for the antiferromagnetic case, which agrees somewhat less, but also the antiferromagnetic case is more difficult. We have fewer system sizes, so we cannot get such a good scaling. But it looks like this thing scales reasonably with system size, so it does behave as a kind of observable, physical observable in some sense. Okay, so time for me to conclude. So, okay, maybe I can show you some open questions from this. So one thing that I told you about was we can measure how far a non-interacting, an interacting ground state is from some closest free state. Okay, that's one thing you can do. But you can also ask a stronger thing. So can you actually give me a model, a non-interacting model, which will produce that ground state? This is something that's more complicated. It possibly can be done using MPS techniques. But the answer, of course, may not be unique. However, in our example of the quantumizing, it's actually a simple thing to do because we can cheat, right? So it turns out that the actual free model is going to be just the transversizing model, okay? So then if you sit somewhere in the phase diagram, like here, you can ask the question, okay, so what's the value of the transversizing model? What's the value of the parameters of the transversizing that will give me the effective free model? And that's what these contour lines show you. So if you sit here, it tells you that HZ field has to be basically equal to 15. If you're here, it tells you it has to be 100. So you recognize that there is some kind of duality transformation here which sends you between small h to large h. So that's something we know on the transverse line, but as far as I understand, this duality, we don't really know how if it holds and how it works if you're in general somewhere in this phase diagram. But this calculation at least suggests that it might be possible to generalize such results. The other interesting thing is, can we apply this to some genuinely interacting system? So something that we expect to be, you know, to give us some non-perturbative interesting physics. And of course, there are many candidates for that, like fractional quantum Hall states, or quantum spin liquids, or whatnot. And there's actually some interesting precursor work to all this, where people show that some of these quantum Hall states, like the Laughlin one-third state, can actually be approximated by an integer quantum Hall state. At least the entanglement spectra of the two can be closely fitted together. So if you basically use an expansion for the integer quantum Hall state single particle energies, and you expand it in terms of this quantum number j, so these people show that if you just keep these four variational coefficients, you can match the two entanglement spectra with very high accuracy. So this is the black lines here are the Laughlin state entanglement spectrum, and the green lines are what they get by just fitting these four parameters. Now here, there's a really large number of these entanglement levels, so it is quite surprising that by just fitting these four parameters, you do find a match between these two. And now with this framework that we have for this DF, perhaps we can understand this feature in some more deep way, I would expect. And the other thing, of course, it would be very nice to understand if, you know, some non-abelian states can be thought of in the same way as coming from some, you know, non-interacting because of freedom. So that's currently an open question. And I think it would be quite interesting to explore it further. Okay, so to conclude, I wanted to tell you about entanglement spectrum and convince you that it still tells us some new aspects of physics of quantum main body systems. And in strongly disordered systems, I told you that basically the rank of the Schmidt eigenvalues emerges as an effective quantum number, and the entanglement spectrum has this power law, and that's basically a consequence of the fact that you have these extensively many local integrals of motion in those phases. And then in the second part, I told you about this interaction distance, which we can use to measure how far some unknown state is from the closest free state. And so there were some interesting examples from these simple Ising models, which tell us that large parts of these phase diagrams in these models are extremely simple. I think that's something that perhaps is not generally known, and it would be interesting to look at, for example, how you can simplify these things even further beyond some just doing some MPS calculation, but really getting some analytical understanding of the entirety of these phase diagrams. And of course, it would be perhaps most interesting if you can identify, in some sense, the most interacting points in the phase diagrams of these systems, and then focus to, understand these points, because that's, where we expect most of the new interesting physics might be hiding. And okay, so with that, I just want to acknowledge the people who were involved in this, in particular, Chris, who is here. He's done work on this interaction distance in the second part. And right, and one advertisement. I want to steal the KATP prime time to invite you to come to this Royal Society meeting that we are running in February. If you're interested in the questions of non-ergodic dynamics, integrability, and anything like that, so you're very welcome to apply. And we have already quite an interesting group of people who will be there. So we hope to see you as well. So thanks a lot for your attention.
So if you do a many-body calculation in degenerate perturbation theory, you have a bunch of very large number of degenerate states. Is my interpretation right? The interaction distance has to be zero. Because the states you're calculating are linear combinations of free states.
Let me see if I understand. So you have a degenerate manifold of some many-body states.
A degenerate, yeah. You have non-interacting, there's a high degeneracy. And now you turn on the interaction, you diagonalize, and all the states will be a finite linear combination of those degenerate states. So won't the interaction distance be zero?
No, but we look at the reduced density matrix for a subsystem.
Okay.
So I don't see a reason why it has to be. We don't look at the entire state.
Oh, it's not the entire state.
No, it's not. It's, you look at the, yeah, it trades out half, and then, of course, it can be zero.
A question about if you go to very large systems, it seems that basically it's always zero in your numerics, except exactly at a critical point.
But for these simple models, so if we look at... if you look at the ferromagnetic case, the entire phase diagram will be zero other than, this vicinity of the critical point, right? And in this case, actually, the entire phase diagram will go to zero. But this is a special case. I don't see that has to be a general result. There could be, and in fact, it isn't a general result. We can talk about, we have specific examples where you can construct a state that in thermodynamic limit will have DF non-zero.
But can you construct a Hamiltonian then?
Yes.
Okay.
It's a power fermion Hamiltonian.
Okay.
So if you take the Fendley model for free power fermions at the fixed point, so that the ground state of that model will have DF, which is non-zero in thermodynamic limit. So that's a whole other area which I unfortunately didn't have the time to discuss, but we can construct genuinely interacting states, and somehow they happen to be related to power fermions.
So maybe just a short question. So you can define like a distance by just literally minimizing the modulus of the difference between the frequency and wave function.
Yeah.
So what's the relation between that distance and this distance?
What distance?
So by minimizing the modular difference of the frequency wave function and the this
function. You mean like a fidelity thing?
Fidelity
is related to this trace distance that I used. But normally, when people calculate fidelity, it's calculated in some given basis. So it will depend on.
When does it depend on distance? You're just minimizing some. You only need
by. Fidelity is like an overlap, right? So.
Yeah, sort of like overlap, but not exactly the same. And then you like doing similar to what you do, but just measuring the difference between the two-way function. Why is the frequency wave function which you control the arbitrary stage of interval?
But that's probably so you want to take the full wave function.
Yeah.
I don't think that will be. Yeah. That's okay. So that's similar to this. It will have a problem in the sense that. Let's discuss this. I'm not sure that it will be useful.
Okay.